Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Next month in Copenhagen, world nations meet to try to set hard new goals for greenhouse gas emission reductions to head off global climate change. For many, the great hope has been that the U.S. would show up with ambitious new climate legislation to prove its commitment. The House passed a bill in June, the Senate not yet, and maybe not at all before Copenhagen. This hour, On Point, America's domestic climate politics and their global implications. You can join the conversation. Will the U.S. go to the global climate conference empty-handed? Are you rooting for an American climate bill, cap and trade, all the rest, or dreading it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Margaret Criz Hobson, energy and environment correspondent for National Journal. She's been reporting on the climate players and politics and what it all may mean come Copenhagen. Margie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And this is very much in action today. We've got the Environment and Public Works Committee in the U.S. Senate, chaired by Barbara Boxer. Republicans have been straight up boycotting this committee where she was trying to mark up a climate bill. But this morning, there's action.
Exactly. There had been 3 days of what were deemed hearings, and then this week there were 3 days when they were trying to cajole the Republicans to come on board and discuss this with them, debate it, put in it amendments. And the Republicans said, no, we want more information about how much this is going to cost. So the Democrats this morning decided to go forward on their own. There's a loophole in the rules for the committee that said if you don't pass it with any amendments at all, then you can pass it by Democrat only. And in this case, it was Democrats, and one of them voted against it, Senator Max Baucus.
Of Montana. So a 10-to-1 vote, no Republicans on board. Critics, Republicans, called this the nuclear option, saying you can't do this. You break precedent. You sort of break faith with a bipartisan effort. You can't do it. But it's done at this point. What happens now?
Well, just back up a second. Mm-hmm. In terms of this committee, I don't think there's one or two Republicans that would have voted for it no matter what, even if they had gotten more information on the cost. For the most part, this was a very conservative group of Republicans on this committee. So going forward now, you know, everyone had said early on that whatever this committee did would only be slightly looked at by the Democratic leadership. From now on, it's up to Senator Harry Reid, who is the majority leader in the Senate. And you have three senators, John Kerry, a Democrat from Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, and Joe Lieberman, an independent from Connecticut, who are saying, well, we don't know what's happening over there, but a dual track here. We're going to go forward on our own and try to put together our own bill with a broader group of senators supporting it.
Now, you've got four Republican senators this morning who have been very much engaged here, including Lindsey Graham, who's been outspoken with John Kerry, the Democrat, about getting something here. But he and Olympia Snow and Judd Gregg of New Hampshire, Susan Collins, Maine, all saying that without this further investigation of the cost of this, they're not going to be on board. We cannot support legislation without this information, they're saying.
Well, they could not support legislation. They would not vote for it. But you will see behind the scenes a lot of discussions going on, and I wouldn't be surprised if all four of those senators are in the room at the same time this discussion is going on. They're going to hammer out legislation. And in the meantime, you'll see EPA quietly doing some of these reports that they've asked for.
What are the odds at this point, do you think, Margie, of the U.S. coming to Copenhagen with a bill in hand, passed through both houses and signed by the president, saying here's what we're going to do about greenhouse gas emissions?
I think the chances are almost nil.
And what does that mean for Copenhagen? If the U.S. doesn't show up with that, I mean, John Kerry had at one time said, Senator Kerry, if we bring this, it's going to be a great prod to global action. Now he's saying if there's global action, it'll be a great prod to us.
It's pretty sad, isn't it? Yeah, I think that everybody was looking at Copenhagen as a make-or-break opportunity for the world. And now, considering what's happening in the Senate and the fact that things have slowed down, you had health care, people's times have been so diverted. You've got a lot more concern about the economy. That going to Copenhagen, they're going to have much lower expectations. And I think that people, when you talk to them about what's going on in Copenhagen and in preparation, they're already lowering their expectations. expectations.
Boy, yeah, the whole world's been listening as we've been told that this, as you say, is make or break. Gordon Brown, British Prime Minister, saying that just last month, that if the world doesn't take action now, there won't be time to repair the damage later. Margie Hobson with National Journal, please stand by in Washington. We're also joined right now from the Capitol by Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, Democratic senator from Ohio, widely considered to be a Senate's kind of point man on the industrial Midwest in the Democratic Party anyway. Sherrod Brown, thanks very much for being here. Welcome back to On Point.
Tom, glad to be with you. Thank you for sure.
You have been saying that you're all for trying to take care of climate change, but you're also very concerned about the economy in your state and others. Are you for pushing something through here, cap and trade and all the rest, before Copenhagen or not?
I think the question is we're not going to finish this with health care before Copenhagen, so that's a bit of a moot point. I'm for moving as quickly as we can if we do it right, and to me, this is a jobs bill. This is I was talking to John Dorn, who is the sort of guru of financing much of the Silicon Valley, if that's the way to describe
John
it.
John Dorn, venture capitalist, yeah.
Right, and he said if you price carbon, you unleash capital, and I know in my state of Ohio, we have more solar energy jobs in Toledo, Ohio than any city in America. I won't do this on this show, but I could take you a tour around Ohio where all kinds of things are beginning to happen. Some have happened already with all kinds of alternative energy, with wind turbines and fuel cells and biomass and solar. And if we do climate change the way we should to make sure we preserve manufacturing and not end up losing jobs, the company closes down in Lima, Ohio and moves to Shanghai, you both lose jobs and you have more CO2 emissions. We do the manufacturing component right. This really does mean new industries, alternative energy jobs that we have never had before. And it's no longer the environment versus what's good for the economy. If we do it right, it's both.
Okay, but take this down to just the real basics, Senator. You're saying climate change is a jobs issue. The scientists are saying if we don't take action on emissions now, we may not have a planet, you know, with jobs on it. So are you saving jobs now, but they're going to, you know, be working in a frying pan or you know, 30 years down the road?
The question's appropriate. No, my environmental record in 17 years in the House and Senate is close to 100%. I want to vote for this bill. I think climate change is real. I think it's largely or significantly man-made, humankind-induced, whatever. But I think it's a very important moral issue. I'm not saying slow down. I'm saying do this in a way that works for manufacturing and preserving the kinds of manufacturing we have now, not the number of auto and steel jobs perhaps that we had 20 years ago. I understand that. But that also means that if you can make glass for autos, you can make glass for solar panels. If you make gears for trucks, you can make gearboxes for wind turbines. We can do those things. We're not going to get done by Copenhagen, but we want to send a message to the world that we're serious. Some of the committees have moved on it. The House has already passed it, and begin the and sort of accelerate the negotiations we're doing to bring China, India, and the European Union especially into this, and I think we make major progress.
But maybe this is just a matter of how it was spun to the world, but sort of the message was, we've got to do this year at Copenhagen, or we're in deep soup. And you're saying now, well, now maybe not. I mean, if the U.S. does not show up with an action plan in hand, we were told that was going to be a big prompt to the rest of the world to act as well, and the rest of the world does not act, are we sort of dooming ourselves to some kind of, you know, hot earth scenario where the jobs don't matter anymore?
I guess I never was at all certain that we would pass have a climate change bill on the president's desk before mid-December. I don't know that I don't think many of us thought that would be possible as much as we want to because of the economy, because of health care, and not that the Senate can't do two things at once, but these are huge, hugely complex issues, as you know, Tom, on all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when we go to Copenhagen, and a bunch of us are going that have similar ultimate interests but have slightly different paths to get there, and Senator Boxer and Senator Kerry in my path, we're going to end up going down the same path, and we're going to see compromise and all that, because we all believe, I think a majority of the Senate, a strong majority, believes that climate change is a very important moral issue of our generation. But I think if we show major progress and we talk to the rest of the world, there is no drop-dead date of mid-December, and it just can't happen. There's no way we're going to be able to do it by then with health care and the complexities of this issue. So I think if there's major progress, you know, the Boxer, the Environment Public Works Committee's voted something out. Another committee has. We go to Copenhagen. We have a sort of a tour de force of a lot of us working on this with a very serious goal in mind. The negotiations with the rest of the world are going to move forward more quickly than they would have otherwise. Ideally, we would have done, well, ideally, it's not just done it in Copenhagen, ideally we would have done it during the Bush years, but that wasn't politically going to happen because a lot of people in that group didn't believe it was real. So where I think we made good progress, I think we need to move as quickly but intelligently as possible and do it next year.
Progress, but the clock's ticking. Copenhagen's next month. You're not going to have a bill there. Are you ever going to sign off on something, Ohio Senator Brown, if it doesn't have some kind of a trade protections in it, geared against products that come from, let's say, a China without green controls?
No, I'm not. And I'm not because I don't believe this is an important issue, but because it would be CO2, it would be worse for the environment. As I said, if a company shuts down in Mansfield, Ohio and moves to Wuhan, China, Mansfield, Ohio loses hundreds of jobs, and in Wuhan they emit more CO2 than they did in Mansfield. So it doesn't work for the environment without this. So I'm not going to be sanding the gears, and I'm not going to be obstructionist. I just want this to work. I'm as strong a believer in the problems of climate change and the solutions to climate change and the necessity for it, the moral underpinning of it, as anybody in the Senate.
But it's not happening right now. Senator Brown, please stand by. We have to take a very short break. We've got more questions for you. We're very glad you're with us. Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Margaret Criz Hobson of National Journal, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about U.S. climate change politics 1 month before Copenhagen and the implications of no American action on Capitol Hill, in the Senate anyway. Margaret Criz Hobson joins us from the National Journal, and U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio is here. We've just got him for a couple more minutes, and Senator Brown, we've got questions from our listeners. Beth in Earhart, South Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Brown.
Yes, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for this very important topic this morning. As an American, you know, I'm proud to be an American, but we have shown up for climate change conferences so many times now with nothing in hand. Prior administrations have done this. And so, for example, my Senator Graham in South Carolina, he's been in the Senate long enough to have gotten some support from his party to have taken care of a plan long before now. It's
well,
not like
he says he's for it now. What's your question for Senator Brown, who's with us right now, Beth?
Yes, sir. Can you put politics aside and take care of our planet? We need to, Americans, the American Congress and the Senate, they need to put their differences party-wise aside and present a plan from America to, you know, to bolster our national status throughout the world.
Yeah, Beth, we've got it. Senator Brown, we just got you for a minute. What do you say? There's a concerned American citizen.
Thank you, Ms. Earhart. And interesting you mentioned your senator, because there was an announcement yesterday of Senator Kerry, one of the two main drivers of climate change legislation, with Senator Lieberman, who's an independent, Kerry, a Democrat, of course, and your senator, your senior Senator Graham, announcing that they are working, a Republican announcing they are working together to try to figure out how to bring more Republicans on board and do a good climate change bill. And I think all of that is welcome. I dispute, and I absolutely believe you're right that we need to do this across party lines and across ideological divides as much as possible. Ideologically, though, a lot of Republicans simply don't think that climate change is an issue, that it's not real, that the climate's not really changing, and then if it is, it's not really caused by humans.
But you do, and you're still not ready to vote for something now.
I understand that, but I've explained exactly, Tom, why what I want in it, and I will support it when it does that. And Boxer and Kerry and others are clear about that. But I also don't. I reject the the assertion that, that both Ms. Earhart and you made, Tom, that we were going to Copenhagen empty-handed. Just because we haven't had a final bill doesn't mean it's empty-handed. I mean, people are sophisticated enough at Copenhagen and other countries to see the U.S. government's made major strides. The House passed a bill, the president's for it, and the Senate's gotten much of the way down the road. So I don't think it's a question, well, the Americans don't care when we go there. We have negotiators that are high rank, that are serious about this, and even the people like me that aren't supporting it yet want to support it and will support it once we do A, B, and C, which I think we will do A, B, and C. It's not a negotiating vehicle I'm using to try to dodge this any more than I'm dodging your questions.
Mm-hmm. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, I know we've got to let you go. We'll dig into exactly that. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very, very much, and thanks to Margaret for her comments. See ya.
Margie, stand by. Joining us right now from Washington, Dave Hamilton. He's director of the Sierra Club's Global Warming and Energy Program. Dave Hamilton, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
So give us your kind of environmentalist summary on this. Is it, as Sherrod Brown says, not there yet, but that's okay from an environmental perspective? It's going to come together, and the world will be just fine if it sees Americans talking about it, even if they don't have it in hand. Do you agree with Margie that there's basically no chance at this point, or near to nil, of going to Copenhagen with the climate bill?
Yeah, I think they're both right. They're both obviously astute watchers and shapers of what goes on here. I think even a few months ago, we had to realize that Copenhagen was going to be part of a process and not necessarily the end-all and be-all. I think anybody who watches the U.S. system closely, you know, can tell that both the administration and Congress put health care up front. And that those of us who work on climate legislation and energy legislation know and have known that we are not masters of our own destiny, that we're basically sitting in traffic behind healthcare. So there are, there are reasons that this hasn't moved forward that are completely independent of the issue. So, you really have to look at the whole of the situation and, not just decide that the Senate is either not going to or is incapable of producing a serious proposal.
I would think at some level, as an environmentalist, you might say that nothing is independent of this issue.
I might, but unfortunately, I've worked here long enough that you have to work with what else is on the plate of the Congress and the Senate. I mean, certainly we think this is the most important thing that is pending right now. We, like Senator Brown, I believe, we believe this should have been dealt with 10 years ago. And that, it is an issue that is, critically important for the future of our children and our ability to, live in the future the way we live now.
If I may, just let me put forward, just to deal with this, and then we'll move on to the details of this and the cost of it, which is not insignificant, but you had British Prime Minister Gordon Brown saying in mid-October, that's just weeks ago, in a preparatory meeting of environment ministers heading toward Copenhagen, I'm quoting him here, he said, "If we do not reach a deal at this time, no retrospective global agreement in some future period can undo that choice. By then, it will be irretrievably too late." Is that wrong?
Well, that's a call that's made by scientists, and I am not one of those. I am a policy guy and an activist.
You're the Sierra Club.
I am, the Sierra Club doesn't purport to be climate scientists. We do read what the climate scientists say, and they regard this as an urgent moment and that we really don't have a lot of time to waste. I think the question is, are we now at a point where if it doesn't happen between now and Christmas or the holidays, is that the death knell of climate legislation? Is that the death knell of an international agreement? And I don't think it is at all.
Margie Hobson, jump in here with us. First, we'll look outside and then back to the U.S. But as far as Copenhagen goes, are you watching it at this point with the U.S. coming with what it will or will not have? Are there still hopes that some kind of significant agreement will be reached there about carbon emission reductions? Or is that also now out the window?
No, I think you can see something happening. I don't think it's going to be the type of thing you're sort of putting up as the ultimate goal here. And what Brown had said, and German leader Merkel also had spoken to the Congress about mm-hmm. how we need to move forward. But there's a political reality here. We're dealing with a Congress that is still split, even if the Democrats control both the House and the Senate. It's still split, and the Republican victories on Tuesday, I think, made this more complicated, too. They're not going to back down. I think you could still see coming out of Copenhagen some kind of a reconfirming sort of the commitments that the developed countries, the G8, had made in previous times of saying, yes, we're going to all get together and control our CO2 emissions. I think you could see a sort of an agreement that the developing countries, the Chinas, the Indias, the Brazils, can take part in this sort of a climate agreement, and they don't have to necessarily do the same things that the EU and the U.S. do. And I think that you could see some sort of strike, maybe the attempt by the U.S. to strike some bilateral agreements. But ultimately, what we're talking about doing is setting up a forum, setting up a process where we can reconvene at a future time after this is all over with in this process, trying to get climate change legislation and reconsider all the things that are going forward.
Well, I think it's confusing for ordinary people. I mean, we had you had Todd Stern, the State Department Special Envoy on Climate Change. That's President Obama's top negotiator. And he's saying yesterday that the administration wants more than a, quote, roadmap for future negotiations, that, you know, that's not enough. But you're saying that may be, at this point, maybe the best that we can expect from Copenhagen.
I think that's the plan B, and I think people are very quickly moving to plan B. You cannot get a piece of legislation through the Senate unless some sort of miraculous agreement is reached in the next couple weeks before Copenhagen. You can get them negotiating something on the Senate floor. That would look really good. And, you know, the administration has done a lot of things on its own in the administration, sort of the regulatory side, to control CO2. So you can see them bragging about the things that we have done. This is a lot different than the Bush administration, where none of these things had happened. So to say that mm-hmm. this is the same as the Bush administration is wrong.
And of course, there's the threat that's been put out by the Obama administration that if Congress doesn't act, the EPA will, and starting next spring, Margie.
Yes, exactly. They very well could. And I think that it's already starting to pop up in a lot of different areas of the administration. Different regulatory agencies are already starting to consider climate change in land use policy and a variety of other areas. You had the Securities and Exchange Commission talking about how climate change should be considered by corporations as they start to disclose their financials on a regular basis. These are issues that when embedded in the regulatory process, they have a big effect.
Let's get a call from New York, Orchard Park, New York, and Shannon. Shannon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My questions may have been answered in the course mm-hmm. of the discussion, but there are several. The first one is, I'd like to know how long our policymakers have known that this very important conference is coming up, and when they started to actually do something about it. I think it's very important that the United States stop talking and offering excuses and start actually moving forward and doing something. I'll listen for the response from your guest. Thank you.
Thank you, Shannon. I mean, Dave Hamilton, Copenhagen's been on the table for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it was set up as the goal of the Bali Roadmap. So it has been, you know, kind of the shining end of the tunnel. You know, I think if you look at, you know, one of the things that has put up a big obstacle is the actual change of the government, the fact that...
From Bush to Obama.
Right, from Bush to Obama, that for, you know, the first 5 months of this year, very few people had been confirmed. The agencies weren't filled. All sorts of things were running at half speed. The death of Senator Kennedy, you had a whole lot of things.
And then came health care in the middle of
right.
everything.
You know, you had a whole lot of things that were stopping this up that were not an abdication of a willingness to do this. Now, this morning, the Environment and Public Works Committee in the mm-hmm. Senate reported a bill with no Republican participation. Mm-hmm. So, again, there's a pretty distinct cleavage here between you know, Democrats that are anxious to do something, that believe this is a critical issue, and Republicans who are absolutely in a just say no mode.
But we even heard Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio saying he's not ready to say yes either.
Well, he's not ready to say yes, but he knows what the issues are. And these are the same issues that were up in the House bill and where, you know, similar interests as those that are in play in the Senate came to agreement and passed a bill. And that, you know, it is simply the 60-vote margin. It is the ability of Republicans to declare this something that is somehow does not need to live by majority rule. It is the need to get 60 votes, which is why we haven't passed a bill by now.
Let's get a call from Maggie in Arlington, Massachusetts. Maggie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm with climatesos.org and securegreenfuture.org. There's a lot of information up there. I just want to say that at the beginning so that people can look up. But there's a lot of false solutions in the U.S. climate bill. And in fact, the biggest one is the cap and trade system, the whole framework. So Dr. James Hansen, probably the nation's top climatologist, has said that this bill is worse than doing nothing at all to the environment. So that tells us a lot. And the cap and trade is actually, the cap is not just to cap the emissions. It's actually also serving as a floor. The emissions will not fall below the cap as it is hoped not to be exceeded. In fact, it will be exceeded just because of the offsets and a lot of the other problems that will, you know, make sure that the emission actually will go beyond the cap. So the cap is actually only on paper.
Maggie, let us dig into exactly that. I appreciate your raising that, Margie. You know, on the bill itself, we've got a lot we want to dig into there. But, I mean, there's still, Europe's been working with cap and trade for some time. They've seen significant problems there. Do the supporters of the bill in the House, the bill coming together in the Senate, believe that it is, you know, that it will have the effect of bringing down greenhouse gas emissions as scientists say we need to?
Yes, I think that they're all basing it on another cap and trade program that we had on sulfur dioxide, acid rain for the Midwestern coal plants. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it went well beyond the cap that had been set. That was only one sector, though. That was just coal-fired power plants. This is much broader. It's a lot more controversial. I think that the questions about whether cap and trade is the best way of going forward have been raised a little bit more recently, I'd say. And you know, up until this point, everything has been cap and trade. This is the way we're going to go forward. We're going to try and those offsets she's talking about. That's to make sure that when you tell the coal-fired power plants in the Midwest that they have to lower their emissions, mm-hmm. and that the cost of electricity to them doesn't go up so high, because obviously they're going to have to pay for any kind of new pollution control programs, mm-hmm. That it doesn't go so high that the people in the Midwest have skyrocketing electricity costs, businesses could leave. There's a lot of concerns about the economic impacts, and that's what the offsets are all about.
The offsets will be there. We've also seen John Kerry and Joe Lieberman and others headed up to the White House recently to get into the sort of nitty-gritty negotiations here, on nuclear and right across the board. Is that an economic conversation that's in the wheelhouse there?
It's an economic conversation, oil and nuclear power, to try and figure out ways of encouraging more development of nuclear power plants. A lot of them are on the drawing board, but whether they actually get built or not, that's controversial. I know there's a lot of environmental groups that say we haven't figured out what to do with our waste yet, but carbon dioxide does not come out of nuclear power plants when they produce electricity. So this is a big, big opportunity, for some would say, to produce more, you know, build more nuclear power plants. And as far as oil and gas, I mean, to make us more energy secure and natural gas has half of the CO2 emissions of coal. And so if you have a natural gas-fired power plants instead of coal-fired power plants, that would be a positive to lower our emissions, at least in the short term. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of discussion. And I think this cap and trade term has gotten to be a bad word, bad words for both the left wing and the right wing.
I I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about U.S. climate change politics 1 month before Copenhagen and the implications of Americans going to Copenhagen without a bill in hand. Dave Hamilton, director of the Sierra Club's Global Warming and Energy Program, is with us from Washington, as is Margaret Criss Hobson. She's energy and environment correspondent at the National Journal. She's reported this up one side and down the other. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Stuart, Florida, and Kevin. Kevin, you're on the air.
I didn't see anything in the stimulus package supporting this initiative, i.e. light rail systems or nuclear power. And it's really disappointing to hear the left constantly berate the Republicans. Well, they would have supported that. They would have created jobs. I mean, I don't see the left being honest. It seems to be something other than, this is how we're going to solve the problem. We're going to have another meeting. We're going to have another Copenhagen. Where is the dollars in that $700 billion stimulus package going? If this is such a priority, I'm asking as a taxpayer, where is that money going?
Good question. Dave Hamilton, first to you. Did you see a push toward these goals in the stimulus package?
There was, I believe, nearly $60 billion in the stimulus package that went for energy efficiency and renewable energy. And energy efficiency is the quickest, cleanest, cheapest way you're going to start to deal with this problem. And it was actually a down payment that was reflected in the Energy Information Administration's forecasts of what our ultimate carbon emissions would be, and it bumped it down a couple percent.
So what about, Margie, at this point on nuclear, which our caller Stuart raises, is there money for nuclear, or how's nuclear being treated in the legislation the Senate's working on, though it has not passed?
Well, the stuff that passed in the Boxer Committee today was not. There's some provisions that are for nuclear, but everyone agrees that there's going to be much, much more for nuclear in order for this to pass. It wouldn't be like
so
a
Harry
game changer.
Reid will bring that on.
Harry Reid will bring that on, some of the other committee chairmen. This was not the end of the road for that. It has to go through several other committees, or at least be debated and discussed by other committees. And then privately, there's a number of negotiations going on. Lieberman has been doing holding meetings with a lot of Republicans and some Democrats on nuclear power specifically, as being something that when you get a nuclear provision, if you provide more money, if you provide a better route for building new nuclear power plants, he's hoping you might see more Republican vote for this.
So,
I could just jump in on our caller, on the one hand, you get Republicans often jumping up and down saying, don't pick winners and losers, don't pick winners and losers. But you've got a technology that can't survive in the marketplace, that Wall Street has said, this is a bad risk. It's not something we want to spend money on. And they're jumping up and down and saying, so the federal government is basically going to have to support nuclear power and, you know, create the possibility that it goes forward when the market won't do it. So, you know, again, you've got this, you know, the free marketeers are saying, you know, pick this winner and prop it up with crutches.
The market won't do it, but the market would do it with enough subsidy, Margie, and you're saying that's probably on the way here.
Absolutely. I think that would be included in this if they want to get to 60 votes. And that's, as was said before, we have to get those 60 votes and however they can do it, whatever the calculation is. At this point, I think a lot of people think that includes nuclear.
We talked earlier with a representative of the Industrial Energy Consumers of America, which is really focusing on the costs of this. And, of course, they say this is going to make, you know, American manufacturing uncompetitive. It's going to drive up costs for consumers. It's going to mean household energy costs are higher. Dave Hamilton, how do you see that? Are the costs attendant with this manageable in the economy we're facing now? Or do you put that to one side because the risks in climate change are so great?
Well, I think what we found in public opinion and also the EPA, CBO, and other analyses of both the Waxman bill from the House is that the costs are, in fact, manageable if we have aggressive efforts on energy efficiency to attack energy waste and bring down demand, because the more you bring down demand, the more you bring down energy cost. So the projections from EPA are that it's, you know, roughly about, you know, 30 cents a day per family. You know, it's about $100 a year, which is not insignificant for most family budgets. But when asked these questions, people think that, you know, really moving forward toward creating a clean energy economy and tackling global warming is actually worth that.
Let's get a call from John in Amherst, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Moral obligations to the future aside, and the weaknesses in the economic arguments that are being made in that nobody's mentioning things like how Europe is eating our lunch in terms of wind technology, Asia in terms of solar technology development. What about the defense angle? Our Defense Department recently pegged climate change as the strategic threat to the U.S. in the future. Why isn't this being, I mean, if the Republicans aren't listening to moral arguments or vaguely listening to economic arguments, why can't the Democrats use the defense angle to sell this to Republicans and conservatives?
John, thanks. Margie, does that show up in this debate? We did see some Defense Department reports, you know, warning of real ramifications that would be difficult to handle. But is there military brass showing up in this debate, or are they sidelined here?
No, they're definitely showing up in this debate, and I think that that's one of the arguments that are made that seem to attract more sort of the moderate Republicans. But, you know, you have to understand that the Republicans in the Senate and in Congress overall, I would say a good majority of them don't believe that climate change is happening or that we are causing it. Or there's a real split here in the whole belief system of what climate change is all about between the Republicans and the Democrats. That said, I think that the security issue, the climate change security issue, has been brought up by a lot of people. They've gone to the Hill, they've talked about it, but so far that hasn't, you know, swayed enough votes.
Of course. Yes, Dave?
Well, I think you have to actually ask the question whether there's any factual or rational argument that's going to move a set of Republicans whose primary goal is to defeat any presidential initiative.
But we've also got Democrats who are not exactly rushing. I mean, Sherrod Brown, we talked to him before, he says he's all for it, but he's got some pretty tall requirements. He said he would not be on board without some protection from manufacturing in countries that may not have, I don't know, the same or similar sort of green laws in effect. And one of the things I want to talk about that he and others are talking about is a border adjustment, Margie. And I guess that's a kind of, tax or tariff that would be on imports from countries that don't have green legislation comparable to what the U.S. ultimately comes up with. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. It's something that would be applied to imports from countries that, like China, that haven't agreed to some kind of really, you know, tangible limitations on their CO2 emissions, their greenhouse gas emissions, so that you would say, okay, if you're importing steel, how many greenhouse gas emissions came out of the steel when it was being manufactured in China? And according to that, we will slap a fee on that to equivalent the same amount, theoretically equivalent the same amount of what you would have paid to have it here in carbon credits, because what you have to do under the cap and trade program is buy a credit for every ton of CO2 that you emit.
But it ends up being a kind of tariff, or acting as a tariff.
Absolutely. It's a tariff, and I have to say that the free market people, including John McCain, who had been a big supporter of climate change legislation in previous years — he's not been as involved this year at all — but he has said that if it includes a tariff provision, sort of anti-free trade provision, he would be against it.
Wasn't Barack Obama against that? Where's the administration on that? As Sherrod Brown said, he wouldn't vote for something that didn't have that. Is there a majority even among Democrats favoring that?
No, there's not. I think, you know, what you're talking about here is the difference between some of the Republicans who say there's no way, there's nothing you could do with this legislation that could possibly convince me to vote for it. And now you're getting into the sort of the nitty-gritty of what's in here and how can we make it so that my region of the country isn't impacted by it, or an industry that's really important to me isn't impacted for it. And then you get into regional debates, because you've got the industrial, the Rust Belt in the Midwest, the coal companies in the Midwest, the coal mining in the Rocky Mountain West as well.
But those are just as important as the party split, right? Being Sherrod Brown,
absolutely.
Democrat, says he would not vote for it without that protection.
Well, they're being voted for. I mean, Sherrod Brown is a Democrat, oftentimes looked at as liberal, but he's from Ohio, where it's a Rust Belt state, and you have to worry about jobs. If he doesn't worry about jobs, he's not going to be reelected.
Dave Hamilton, I hear you there.
Yeah, this isn't an outlandish proposal. I testified in the Ways and Means Committee in the House. We can't simply set up a system that is going to increase costs for trade-vulnerable industries and drive what remaining manufacturing capability we have to Asia. We just can't do that. It's not, you know, we have to be able to tell our industries that if we're going to make them incur extra costs in order to reduce carbon emissions, that they aren't going to be, you know, critically penalized for doing that.
No, anyone could understand that, and yet Margie's saying, you know, the votes aren't there for that. He won't vote without it, so they're not there unless it's there, and it ends up feeling sometimes like stalemate. Ted in Vinton, Iowa, you're on the air.
Yeah, you haven't mentioned anything about wind generators. There's no emissions, there's no waste, and there's a lot of power there for your electricity.
Absolutely. Let us pick it up. Margie, wind and solar. We've talked about nuclear and the big push for that in here. Where does wind and solar come in the legislation that's, trying to make its way here?
Well, it was included in the stimulus package. There's a lot of money for the alternative energy sources. The provisions that were passed by an energy committee earlier would have, if indeed it does pass either independently or as part of the climate change, would tell all of the power plants in the nation that they have to use a certain amount of alternative fuel. In this case, you know, wind, solar, geothermal, wave power, all of those things. So it would say you have to use, 10%, 15% of your electricity that you generate has to be from these green sources. So there are provisions in there if something passes. And getting back to what you were talking about in terms of, one group won't agree to the tariff, another group will agree, says they have to have the tariff. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the 60 votes. If you can put together a coalition and the right a number of sweeteners, as we like to say here in Washington, for certain groups of people, for certain regions of the country to make their pain be lessened, then you can pass something.
Do you see it there at some point? I mean, everybody, John Kerry is saying, if we don't do this soon, certainly before 2011 and the road to the next presidential election, it won't happen. Others say, if you don't get it done before you get near the midterms, it won't happen. So do you see 60 votes out there in any kind of time frame? Shy of the next 4th of July, Margie?
Well, the best analysis I saw said about 50-50 chance of getting a bill passed into the president by, certainly bill passed through the Senate in the first quarter of 2010. So in other words, get through this whole business with the boycotts and the partisanship here. Get to Copenhagen and get through that, and then let's get real serious about what we can pass on our own in order to put something together. Get it to the president's desk, and then by maybe spring we could see a bill. That's about a 50-50 chance. Once you get beyond that, it gets into the midterm elections for November of 2010, and that's a whole other game.
50-50. Wow. John, Concord, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Yes, getting back to Copenhagen, I think we can and must at Copenhagen commit to an undefined mandatory reduction of greenhouse gases. Otherwise, the international community might just leave demoralized and the momentum will be gone. EPA regulation has given us the credibility to do this. When industry sees what Lisa Jackson is going to do to them, they'll beg for a congressional bill to preempt regulation. But the EPA has got November 18th to their first hearing date, and by spring they will have regulate every emitter over 25,000 tons. So I think we're at Copenhagen. We must commit to something in principle.
Even if it's undefined, as you say, John, it's a great important point. Dave Hamilton, EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, and the EPA in general, do they have the authority under the law to make the kind of commitment to the world in Copenhagen that the U.S. will do something substantial? And if it's undefined but mandatory, is that persuasive to the rest of the world?
Yeah, I think that not only do they have the authority, but they have the obligation to go forward should they, finish their endangerment finding and find that carbon dioxide is a danger to human health and welfare. They have to go forward. They have to set standards. They have to do what the Clean Air Act says.
And, of course, they haven't for years.
Well, they've only had this authority for the past couple of years because of a court decision around automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bush administration had no inclination to actually move forward. So literally, you're looking at a process that is only 9 months old, and a difficult one at that. But you know, this continues to be an axe hanging over the head of the Congress, which is if, you know, and the Republicans, if you don't want Congress to determine how this goes, then EPA is going to do it. And the maintenance, we've already seen attacks on that authority through the appropriations process and other things. The maintenance of that authority is the ace in the hole for the U.S. in both against the science and against the international process.
Margie, how about it? Do you think it will be persuasive to Copenhagen, the axe hanging over Congress? Will it look like it's got a sharp edge to China and India and Europe and the rest of the world? Will they say, okay, we believe you, even if your legislators don't act, we trust you'll do something, so we will too in cutting carbon emissions?
I think the administration is hoping that's going to be the case. I don't think they have any illusions that this is going to be the be-all, end-all for the negotiations. But it shows that they're serious. It shows that this president, particularly, is not just talking about reductions, but he's actually pushing his regulators, the powers that he has, the ability that he has to do something about it. He's using it.
Well, I am sure we will come back to this as the world gathers at Copenhagen, but this sort of one-month-out briefing has been very informative, and I'm grateful to each of you for helping us dive in here. Dave Hamilton with the Sierra Club, the director of the Global Warming and Energy Program there. Thank you very much for joining us this hour,
Thank
Dave.
You,
and Margaret Chris Hobson at National Journal. Margie, you're just terrific on this, and we hope we can talk with you again when Copenhagen is afoot. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for being here. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Suzanne Merkelson and Patrick Rosso. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.